I'll just grab the mic here to just review what's going to happen in the next few hours. So we're going to begin, as I said, there's a slight change in schedule, so we'll begin at 1 with some remarks from David Grimes, who John Jackham will introduce, I believe. And then we'll have the three panels. And the first panel will be related to UCAR and the Canadian academic community, university community, and opportunities for collaboration arising from what we heard this morning. The second panel will focus on education, rather, and training. And the third panel will look at the bigger picture of research funding, research coordination, and community advocacy. And so if you need details on those panels, they're in the last couple pages of the agenda. And so I will ask John to introduce our speaker.
Very pleased to introduce to you Dr. David Grimes from Environment Canada, who's going to be talking to us, I guess, for a few minutes about various issues with respect to UCAR Canada relations and university community. David?
Thanks. Thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity to say a few words. I thought I might kind of give you a bit of a characterization from, kind of give it a bit of more of a global feel here from a WMO perspective, as well as Environment Canada. So I'll try to just briefly cover kind of those two domains, because I think both of them are important. And thirdly, speak a little about the importance of the kind of relationship that we have and have been established with UCAR from an Environment Canada perspective. So let me start with the World Meteorological Organization, and in particular, I want to highlight two aspects for you. One is the aspect that relates to how the World Meteorological Organization sees the overall community moving, in the sense the messaging that will come from the 185 governments that will be represented at the upcoming Congress. I have just finalized, on behalf of WMO, the strategic plan for 2016 through 2019, which will be adopted or approved, maybe modified, but I'm not quite sure if it'll be modified when we take this to our World Meteorological Congress next May. And in that light, there are seven key areas of priority. And so I think this is important. If you don't want me to share it, it's okay too. I can go on to another topic. But I think you might want to know what is going to be driving, you know, critical government as they see it through the eyes of the sort of weather, water, climate domain that the World Meteorological Organization stands for. That's not to undermine the coordination role they now play in the context of space weather. So space weather, even though it's not got a highlight in the priority, was an area that WMO has recognized is critically important in the context of how it's facilitating its relationship with various space agencies around the world in particular, and felt that you know, the communications, et cetera. So there's, even though it's not sort of got a main line in the priority, it still is an aspect that the World Meteorological Organization has put some attention to. So the seven areas, and in no order, they're not ranked. First one relates to what I might call this aspect of supporting the needs of the aviation industry. And in that particular context, there have been a lot of changes in the International Civil Aviation Organization, which have put some stringent requirements to which WMO as a standards body has established, and therefore members need to comply with those sets of standards. So the first emphasis is getting that, and that's understandable given that there's a lot of people that fly around the world in airplanes, and they land in various airports. There needs to be both quality and competence in people that are servicing that industry. The second area is in climate services, and you'll understand that since the Congress in 2011, we've had an extraordinary Congress, and we've had both a intergovernmental meeting related to the implementation of a global framework for climate services. And the emphasis under that is actually the provision of climate services in support of, not only in support of, but adaptation is a clear focus. And, you know, for those working in the climate science domain, understand that there's going to be large-scale impacts, even if everything was able to turn down all of the greenhouse gas emissions today, you still have implications. We have implications with sea level rise, etc. And so there is a very strong emphasis on actually getting on with the climate services business. Third is WMO is in the process of establishing an integrated global observing system. This has probably been at least a decade, if not 15 years. And its emphasis is actually, instead of having kind of its standard, like its previous emphasis, which was having in situ synoptic stations recognize the whole suite of data sets that would be available. So this past week, for those who were at the Open Science Conference, recognized just the value of satellites, satellite information, how the various climate records, other non-standard WMO-related information needs to be kind of brought and made available to the community at large. So this is, even though I got a little pushback on free and open, there is kind of a free and open orientation. And there will be a key policy that will be debated at the upcoming Congress on climate data, because that's one aspect that is tough to get from various countries of the world, and the emphasis is to make that free and open in a similar way as we do weather. So that is the third. And the fourth deals with the area of the polar domain. And it'll have a clear priority aimed at operational polar weather, climate, and hydrological services. And the emphasis there is, and I'll come back to underscore the importance that research has in that particular domain, but it is an area that a recognition of the significant changes occurring in polar regions, not only from the context of increased maritime activity in the Southern Ocean and in the Arctic Ocean and the various maritime corridors that may sort of pass through the Arctic domain, it's also a very strong emphasis in understanding the influence that the polar regions have on the subtropical regions, and even some expected influences on polar regions, on tropical regions. So there's an orientation that will drive an agenda over the course of the next 4 years, and likely more like a decade. Capacity development is the next, and we've always had a capacity development initiative. And what I will underscore is the human capacity that WMO is focused on there. And WMO is establishing competency-based standards. So if you're going to be an agrometeorologist, there's going to be a competency for that. So it's kind of catching up with the private sector been doing competency-based standards for quite a few years. But WMO and its recognition that it's not just good enough to say you've got these sets of courses and therefore you can be a meteorologist, or you have this set of courses and you can be a meteorological technician. It's now recognized that there will be competencies for the various functions that they'll be carried out. This is important in the education and training domain. This is something you need to think about in terms of whether you'll have an forecaster providing aviation forecasts may have different competency than a forecaster who's going to provide agrometeorological forecasts. And so there is this specialization recognition that will be done across sort of the portfolio. And so that underscores this capacity development initiative. In the next one deals with, and there's an emphasis on urban meteorology and megacities, which I'll come back to, but it's about impact-based forecasts and warnings for high-impact weather, climate, and water events. And this is an area, as you all probably recognize from the IPCC work or the assessment of the IPCC, extremes are kind of tough to understand. And so there's kind of an increased emphasis in trying to understand extremes. And more importantly, how do extremes then equate into enabling service providers, whether they're National Meteorological Services or others, to be able to sort of harness what that knowledge base is in order to provide extremes, particularly as we look to seasonal and subseasonal levels. So I'll come back to that very briefly. And then finally, there's kind of related to kind of the efficiency of the organization, not quite as relevant to you, but certainly relevant to governments. What undermines those key points, of course, is research and the development of human capital. So those are two elements that are important. And in particular, we have a strong emphasis in research in under the weather, World Weather Research Program on sort of six areas. Certainly high impact weather research, so that's getting at extremes. And we believe there's a sort of a crossover effect that'll happen to the climate. And anyone who listened to Julia Salingo's presentation this week, anyone who had that opportunity, would recognize just kind of how the interchange between weather and climate is so important there in the context of extremes. So high-impact weather research. Seasonal to subseasonal work, we've established a project office in Korea that's looking at trying to move from predictions of sort of 1 to 5 to predictions that go out to 30 to 90 days. I mean, in some countries, they provide seasonal forecasts, but the, you know, increasing and enhancing the skills is an important domain. So that's the polar, and there's the Polar Prediction Project. It was discussed during this past week. Critically important, key priority for Canada, of course, because you might have heard yesterday the Prime Minister made an announcement I forgot what it was, somewhere around $20 million in terms of public funding, and hoping to get about $70 million in private sector funding leveraged to support some northern sort of a northern priority, particularly addressing the marine sort of marine safety, better infrastructure. This is with the National Research Council. So there's then for the university community, there's kind of a link there, an opportunity to see what your relationships are with NRC and how that can unfold. But it's very much about building some resilience in northern communities. I had to summarize what those key priorities are, just sort of focus on that, recognizing the risks that are up there. And we have an urban meteorology megacity focus in our research initiative, that and we have a climate engineering, some call it geoengineering, but it's really trying to understand the science of that. So there's kind of, for those who have an interest, we'll see that we'll try to build a significant profile, not necessarily around the politics of it, but more about the base understanding so that it can inform the policies that relate to that. And finally, there's a demonstration project, which is actually pretty close to home. It's in the Great Lakes. This is looking at a coupled hydrological atmospheric modeling initiative to sort of start to develop this in a broader context in other parts of the world, particularly where there are significant water issues or safety issues related to that. So that kind of gives you a picture of kind of the WMO. So now, you know, there's an echo in that in terms of Canada's priorities with regard to how the Meteorological Service sees kind of its evolution. And, you know, high impact weather and improving our hydrological services, put a lot more emphasis on improving our water services over the time. So there's an emphasis in increasing our research capacity or accessibility to sort of research results to inform that. And we have a very strong focus at trying to bring the communities that do monitoring in Canada together in a kind of unified way. So there's a sense of similar to what we heard this morning, there's a way of trying to, and we might actually leverage that kind of capability to sort of build better access to all the data that is actually accessible and usable that may not necessarily just reside with a federal government family. And I would say that we also have strong emphasis, of course, on our NWP, and it's clear in how we're going to support our high-impact weather, higher-resolution kind of modeling and emphasis of research that needs to go into that. And finally, we have also enabling the establishment of effective climate services. There are many players in the climate domain, so it's not just going to be any one agency that does that. So in order to facilitate that, there's a need for how are we going to come up with climate services at large for this country. So there's kind of a, as you picture, of kind of a backdrop. I thought that might be important to share only in the context of how you think about your own plans, but more importantly, what are those critical points of relationship that you may want to establish in the context with UCAR. And so I'm going to come back to the sort of UCAR university relationship. So in this particular context, the significance of I see UCAR, you know, they use the word ucar.edu/opportunity. So that's the word, it's opportunity. And some of you have, you know, relationships at the science level. And one of the purposes for doing this wasn't just to give you a perspective of what all their capability is, although that was one objective, is to share that with you. But it was also this kind of context of how we might build Canadian community in that kind of relationship, take advantage of the opportunities that are presented there. There's a couple of aspects that's important, and I'll just flip back internationally. There's a lot of pressure being put on funding agencies and both from a government basis but even international basis to be collaborative in their investments. And so if you took there's a few initiatives out there, and there's a forum, like a Belmont Forum, to which we have, you know, Canada is a participant, and NSF is a participant, and Europeans are a participant, and then there are development agencies that sort of watch this as well, also bring resources to particular problems and issues. Key there is, and WMO is trying to kind of see how they can influence those forums to do truly integrated studies, bring community together in an international way, to sort of really kind of move the yardsticks forward. And so in that particular context, then, understanding what that sort of, what are the benefits of building stronger liaisons, stronger relationships with UCAR as a Canadian family, and the mechanisms, and one of the challenges I think we need to think about would be, so what are those mechanisms that we can kind of facilitate that? because it's important to inform, help influence, and some of us are in positions, and some of us think we're in positions of influence, to sort of bring messaging forward to those entities that might actually kind of help foster that kind of relationship that you may want to see and how that development goes forward. So that's kind of one challenge. And I can say that, you know, as a benefactor of all of, not only of the good research that's being done and how that manifests itself from kind of research to operations. And one of the principal reasons for reorganizing the Meteorological Service recently was to provide a key conduit for that. And so that's Michelle's group. And Michelle's principle is what I call it science infusion. I want that science infusion so I can show all the good work that you do actually translate into direct benefits for Canadians. And that's not the only reason you do that work, but it's also helpful to be able to reach back and tell that story, that the work that you're doing is actually having a direct benefit on the kind of weather, climate, and water services that we provide as an organization to Canadians. So that's kind of one aspect. So think about the mechanisms. Think about, so my personal commitment to you is I'm not going to, even though I have to leave a bit early, I'm not going to actually abandon you. I actually want to see how to make this work. My personal commitment is to work with you in a way that can facilitate what you want to see come out of this relationship. And that's entirely kind of up to you. After the end of this day and you've had your kind of exploration, you need to go back and then reflect a little bit on how this can go forward. So I'm a champion for you. That's my first point. And I brought you a bit of insight about from the world to what at least my organization's Environment Canada's emphasis is, I didn't talk too much about the climate domain, but climate is critically important and it's key priority for Environment Canada. I didn't mean to leave that out in some of the work we're doing on impact-based studies, but that's trying to facilitate itself now into meaningful climate services that Canadians can get access to or institutions can get access to make the proper decisions in the context of adaptation. So I'll conclude with that. Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. So you mentioned the WMO strategic plan, and in our little packets we have the NCAR strategic plan. What should happen now? Should NCAR go over that and see how it fits with the WMO plan? I assume WMO did not look at this plan to see how it fit, or do we just go off on our merry way and ignore all plans? I mean, other people's plans. This is a serious question. I mean, or do you just assume perhaps that because it's the same sort of people developing this, they will come up with about the same ideas? I just don't know where to go.
I would say that's the answer is in between, because discovery is an important part of research. There's no question. So, you know, there's things that we don't know that we need to know in order to evolve. So. Not everything is kind of this strong mission-driven orientation. Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful about that. The second point I would say, though, is we'll get in consensus from 185 governments, which basically represents the world. I mean, the ones that are not at the table are a few small islands and a few political issues, to be frank. So there's a few political states, and there are a few islands, and that's it. We had them all, we'd have everybody. So the will of the governments to see how they see, in the context of atmosphere and the cryosphere and the hydrosphere, this kind of characterizes their principal domains of interest. WMO has got a significant voice. So you need to take that into consideration when you're developing your plans. Now, as the president, I would encourage you to do that. But I also have to respect that you need to also have some degrees of freedom in trying to understand where are those challenges and what are those questions need to be answered. So you don't want to be overly constrained, but that's why I said it's in between. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly one and it's not exactly the other. I had a question back here.
Yeah, I was interested in the discussion you had about the potential interaction between the poles and the equator as one of your themes. Now, that happens through upper-level motions, Brewer-Dobson circulation, gravity wave effects, and so forth. So the only way to do that is to be more active in the stratosphere and possibly even the cousin, the mesosphere. So does that mean WMO is also putting its upper height of interest as well?
Yes, because under the WMO, we have the Global Atmospheric Watch Program. Of course, so ozone and other stratospheric ozone, other aspects are quite important. And there's been a lot of work. In fact, there was some presentations this week about the strong influence of stratospheric processes and how it influences weather patterns, including kind of this kind of they had a strong relationship between that and these cold vortices that established and they influencing the weather in even subtropical regions. So the answer is yes. They're not. It's not straightforward, I think. Yeah. So,
Bill, turn off the microphone.
Secondly,
okay.
And just an editorial comment, actually. I mean, I think in terms of something like the NCAR strategic plan and the WMO plan, there's quite a high level of overlap. And I think it makes sense because the NCAR planning process is sort of community-driven. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of scientists involved in these kind of international research programs, national up to the international scale. So there's synergies there. And where some of the differences are the role that groups like NCAR can play in helping to implement that broader vision. So I think there's a lot of synergy. The question I have somewhat related to that is, you know, what can we do? What can we do as an academic community? What can we do as a national center or as a university corporation for atmospheric research? Or your thoughts of the work to be done in communicating these plans and the priorities and the community basis for development to the funding agencies. I sometimes become concerned that some of the funding agencies, at least in the U.S., develop plans and priorities without really the kind of consultative process that groups like the WMO goes through with the broader community, and sometimes there's a mismatch. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It makes sense. And if I was to go back into the 80s and 90s, and WMO were all about, I mean, we had things like GWEX. We had very large-scale-based research initiatives. And I've been encouraging this aspect, and we've done it through the Polar Initiative, where there's both there's a science plan that has now been developed for the Polar Prediction Initiative, which is kind of in the weather-to-seasonal scale. And under Ted Shepard, Canadian working at Reading, who is the principal investigator or the lead for pulling the plan together, is in the process of preparing one for the climate. So this is the Polar Climate Prediction System, I think. I forgot the acronym, but that. And the idea is that we're building a joint office, actually, to facilitate those two, because we think that there will be clear overlaps, that there are benefits, cross-benefits. And so the idea is to start to go back and establish these large-scale, big emphasis, put some timelines around it. For instance, in the Polar Prediction Initiative, there will be a year of polar prediction that will be in the 2017 period and beyond. And the value of that, of course, is to sort of create the synergy amongst all of the various governments and how they would see contributing to that. Similar way that we did for IPY. And IPY actually was a great success. Huge amount of science done under IPY. And so it's kind of going back to the things that actually worked, which is lots of advertising around large-scale initiatives that sort of reach out broadly to the international community and allows governments to kind of rally to those. And so as we look at high-impact weather, we're going to drive it in the same direction, in the sense of these aspects of extremes, look at what are the weather and climate domains dimensions of that particular question. And we'd expect that. And there was a special session on this, which would be kind of a white paper. And under the Commission for Atmospheric Sciences, there's going to be this idea of creating that. And we're a little further behind, I think, in the seasonal to sub-seasonal work. We're just trying to, they have an implementation plan now. The idea is to try to give these things very high profile across government so that with the articulate science plan that's had the contribution from the science community built into it, and so this allows for everyone then to find ways of participating. So it's kind of going back to the things that worked. And for me, that was part of this large scale, big scale initiatives that are good rallying points when it comes to putting in proposals and wanting to get them funded. Anything else? All good?
Thank you, David.
Okay. And I apologize for having to skip out a little bit early, but I have a transportation-related dilemma.
That's fine. So now we have panel number one. If we could get panel number one seated up here according to your nameplates. So the idea is that with respect to the three panels this afternoon, we're going to try to hold this to about 50 minutes total so that we have some time towards the end for some discussion. Okay, so once everyone has found their place up here, the title of this panel is Canada's University Community and UCAR Moving Forward to Atmospheric and Earth System Sciences Research. And you can see that there are some discussion questions that are outlined in your briefing document that everybody has been able to see and all the panelists have seen as well. I'd like to introduce the panel members. First of all, Roland Stahl of the University of British Columbia. Second, Bill Large, you've heard already today from NCAR. Third, Pierre Gauthier from University of Quebec at Montreal. And fourth, Nigel Relay, who's a colleague of mine, lives in the same building or works in the same building as mine, and we're going to spend a lot of future days in this particular room because he's an incoming chair of the Department of Geography. Something to look forward to, Nigel. So what I've decided to do is go sort of in reverse order. What we're planning to do is have about a five-minute allocation for each one of the panel members, followed by approximately 5 minutes of discussion. And if we have any subsequent time for a general discussion, we'll take that. And I'm going to start out with Roland to give his very brief PowerPoint presentation.
Okay, thank you. I've had a long relationship with NCAR from when I was a grad student in the early 70s. I learned how to use the Cray computer. Jeannie Adams taught me about that. Let's see if I can get this running here. And let's see if I can get it to play, to view. Let's see here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Page display.
Okay, so we got full screen mode. Is that what you want?
Down here somewhere?
In the main menu that you're on, and then
it disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do Control L.
Control L. That sounds good. So there's full screen. I see it. Okay. One of my experiences, sorry, I wander around the classroom when I lecture. At NCAR, NCAR used to have an aircraft called the Buffalo aircraft. It was a small cargo aircraft with a tail ramp that lowered to put cargo on and off. And there was an experiment over the Caribbean Ocean just off of Florida where they were flying the aircraft to emit chaff into the atmosphere so ground-based radars could track it. Well, this was back in the days when grad students were expendable, and I was a grad student. And so they had me on the tailgate of this aircraft, lowered with a shotgun full of chaff shells that I was supposed to shoot out the back of the aircraft while I was flying high over the Caribbean Ocean. That was insane. But what was even more insane is we hit a bump of turbulence in the air, and I popped off of the ramp and ended up a little further out the edge there. And I had no restraints at all. I was just laying on the ramp. The cargo loader realized that perhaps he should do something, so he attached a line to my belt. Okay, and I survived that flight. So some of my early experiences of NCAR were very exciting, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. Okay, onward. So at UBC, where I am now, we've had strong and growing collaboration. We'll talk about community models and systems. We are heavy users of the WRF model, including components WPS and UPP. Of course, this is the weather research and forecast model, which I misspelled there. Extremely heavy usage. Other members of our community use the community climate model, which has the different acronym, sorry. We use the Development Testbed Center, including MET model evaluation tools. We use heavily the WRF tutorials and user workshops, and online documents and manuals and user forums. What about graphics and software? We're big users of the NCAR command language, the NCAR graphics. We use Viz 5D Plus still, Unidata, IDV, GEMPAC, NetCDF, and we really appreciate the outstanding live help we get from the help desks for IDV and NCL. What about data archives and display? Well, again, data from Unidata. We don't use a live feed, but we go retrieve pieces of data when we need it. The RAL real-time weather webpage we use a lot in teaching, NSEP, NCAR reanalysis data we use, and various archives, stratus, stratocumulus data from various airborne field experiments. For teaching, we are heavy users of Comet MedEd modules as a supplemental resource. We don't use this as our primary content for the whole course. Again, the RAL real-time weather webpage we use. Some of our students have attended courses taught at NCAR, turbulence course and WRF course, many students. And one of my postdocs was an instructor in one of the Comet courses on mountain meteorology a couple times in the summer. Collaboration, joint field programs with ATD, EOL. Co-authoring papers, I've just put copies of a couple papers that my grad students and I recently wrote with some of the NCAR collaborators there. Some of the PhD committees are strengthened by NCAR people serving on the PhD committees. I've had a couple of my grad students be grad student visitors at NCAR. NCAR has hired a couple of my graduates, Luca Delamonica and Josh Hacker, are working at NCAR now. We make use of live and recorded webinars. And tenure and NCAR scientist promotion reviews, you know, occasionally I'm called on to review promotions for NCAR scientists, and of course they're called on to review promotions for some of our faculty. And of course we share assistant editing and referees of journals. Facilities, most recently I have little direct use of NCAR aircraft, radar, and surface sensors, except there is hope of some of our faculty to use the upcoming SentNet surface flux sensors. And we don't use NCAR computers directly. We have our own computers that we run for our operational forecasts that we produce at UBC. What about further opportunities? I'd like NCAR and UCAR to note this new capability we've developed called COMPS, Community Post-Processing System. And this is for post-processing, analogous to what the WRF model is for numerical weather prediction. If you picture the WRF model, of course, there's components of microphysics, radiation, boundary layer surface, and so forth. But in WRF, you have a choice of plugging in different options for microphysics and different options for radiation, and so forth. So what we've developed is also a plug-and-play component-based post-processing system. where you get to select the data, downscale it, correct it, figure out uncertainty for distributed-based, ensemble-based predictions, calibrate the ensemble, and I can't read it here.
What did you say, uploading?
No.
Updating.
And then making deterministic and distributed or ensemble forecasts. And so this is a resource that we now have on GitHub. It's designed for community use, freely available. And we're at the stage where we think many scientists could use it, because no matter what kind of research you do, you want to know whether your research ended up being better than what has been going before. You need to do comparison verifications. You need this post-processing to do the verification. And this is not only designed for research, it is designed for operational forecasting. So if you make daily real-time forecasts, this is set up to verify and to do this post-processing for all those things. The second bullet here, we've seen this in NCAR's talk this morning. It's wonderful. I'm happy to have NCAR scientists come to UBC and help teach our graduate-level courses. That would be a lot of fun, and I think we'd benefit a lot from that. We have about 14 professors. The atmospheric science program at UBC is not a separate department. It's an interdisciplinary program that spans many faculties and many departments, including science, arts, engineering, and agriculture. So many areas. And I love to work with NCAR and UCAR, and I'm sad to say that we're not members. I haven't been able to convince my dean to shell out the money. But with the information I have now, I think I'll make a strong case. So that's it for me. Thank you.
So we're going to try 5 minutes of discussion if you'd like to make some points here to Roland, back and forth.
So in terms of NCAR scientists coming to UBC and teaching and the like, are you always pretty much looking for sort of semester-long or year-long commitments, or are you open to shorter period visits? Because, you know, in this day and age with dual careers and the like, sometimes it's a pretty big commitment to leave your home and everything for a year.
Semester would be easiest. And would also facilitate research as well as teaching, which is what we would hope to do. But we can make do with shorter than semester visits. Some of our courses are team taught courses where they could be taught sequentially. A visiting professor from NCAR could teach for a month or two, and then the rest could be taken over by another professor. We're happy to try different ways to do that. Yes.
Could you possibly elaborate a bit on the conversation that you had with your dean? And because I mean, from a serious perspective, I mean, we're here from Waterloo, seeing if this is a conversation we might possibly have with our dean. You know, what type of comments and reception might we encounter, and what possible reasons were given, if any, for why he or she was reluctant to pull the trigger, as it were.
I hate to say this, but one of the reasons why the dean was reluctant, two reasons. One, it cost money, and two, it seemed like we could have good interaction without paying any money. I hope you continue the free interaction because we've made great advantage of it. Now, from what I've gathered this morning, we have a lot of ammunition to take to the dean. So we're going to make a strong case for it. What is the cost these days?
It works out to about $800 per year. Is what the effective fee is. And in return for that, you're guaranteed that I will fly two of your member representatives to Boulder for 1 week in October, all expenses paid. So if you do the math, you're probably getting a pretty good return on your investment for that.
There's also the additional component being early career scientists within the department that also get a training.
That is correct. We normally will bring one early career scientist that a university may nominate for that. It's important to point out that all the things that we've talked about, we do not restrict. And so your dean is quite correct in saying that we don't turn anything off if you're not a member. But what being a member helps you to do is engage in governance of the organization. You get to select our board of trustees. You get to determine who sits in the UCAR president's position. You get to determine to some extent, the NSF notwithstanding, the directions for the National Center and the sorts of activity that that center wants to go in. And you join 103 other universities in putting your imprimatur on certain issues or topics or things that you want to impress upon funding agencies or policymakers in general.
Well, you know, you're preaching to the choir here.
Understood.
I'd love to join. Do you have a single-pager sheet that I could print out and send to the dean?
We'll make that available to everyone. We have your emails, and we'll be happy to give you that.
Okay, thank you. And back there?
Yeah, my question.
Microphone?
My question is very general. If money requirement is so small, like $800, then why that restriction should be there, whether it's being paid already? I think the payment becomes a difficult issue when the payment is going to the U.S. I think if someone is in the U.S., a dean in the U.S. would be in the same boat if the money is coming to a Canadian organization.
A great question. And in our recent meeting of our members, we actually proposed a bylaw change that would have struck from our bylaws any mention of a fee. You're quite right. We, as you can see, we don't make money on the fees at all. For instance, membership in Ocean Leadership is $10,000 a year to be part of that organization, and so it would make a lot more sense to drop the fees altogether. But unfortunately, our members voted down the bylaw change last year that would have struck that from our bylaws, so I am forced by my bylaws of incorporation to charge this.
Peter.
Yeah, one of the things we found at York to keep the upper management on side is to send deans and vice presidents as our representatives, at least for one of the places, and that's been very positive. They've come back with very positive comments, and it's also helped our program.
Wonderful idea. And back, yes.
Peter's comments brought up an issue which is a very serious concern to me, and that's this issue between management and science. Like 20 years ago, scientists made decisions, scientists made ideas of what their project should be, the managers were there to support it. And now Peter's comment was we have to ingratiate ourselves to the management. And it does reflect a very, very serious change in the way things are done. Nowadays, you talk to someone from Environment Canada who's a manager, they'll talk about my group. I'm the leader of the group. The scientists work for me. And I don't know if it's the same at UCAR or not, but I find this a very, very serious issue is this, what I call the corporatization of science. We now don't even know who the leaders are. Are the leaders the managers or the scientists? Is the research taking precedence, or are the managers defining where we go and the scientists following suit? And I think that's a topic which requires a lot of discussion. I don't say it in any glib sort of manner. And I'm just wondering if the panel has the same feeling that I do, that basically we're being overrun by administrators, which I think is suppressing the inventiveness and the vision that we can produce in science. So I'm just wondering if you have any comment.
Well, you know, maybe that's not an appropriate discussion for this panel.
I would have to say this is probably beyond the scope of what we're going to be talking about at this panel, but it's an important issue. Thank you, Roland. I think we have to move on.
Sure.
So now I'm going to ask Professor Nigel Roulet, who is in fact representing the Canadian Geophysical Union, to make a few comments.
So I'll just want to point out that the chair I'm sitting in is the chair that the principal of McGill sits in when she chairs Senate, so this is probably the only time I'll be here on this side of the table. The second thing that I'll mention to maybe, or all the suggestion is that just to point out the UBCs are freeloading on the three other institutions in Canada, and that usually has a lot of leverage, particularly when you preface that with your ranking versus the other universities. So that might be a strategy to do that.
We only take the top three.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Okay. In seriousness, though, I'm representing the CGU. It stands for the Canadian Geophysical Union. Brian Bramfearn couldn't be here It's actually one of the unfortunate things of having him as a past PhD student. I get to do his work for him here. But the CGU is actually different than the AGU in that we don't have a significant atmospheric science component to the CGU. That's actually served by CMOS, or the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society. The CGU does have scientists, though, and has sections in the CGU that are very interested in the types of things that NCAR does, and in fact has scientists that are part of those sections that do collaborations now and have done collaborations over the last 20 years with NCAR and have worked through UCAR on those various different things. And this is particularly in the area of boundary layer climate and in terrestrial biogeochemistry, trace gases, and carbon cycling. And in fact, interestingly, out of that, through the efforts of a number of scientists that are working in Canada on permafrost, there was a very active exchange in the literature originally between David Lawrence and a number of people, Hawk Wu, my previous PhD supervisor, about how NCAR got it completely wrong when they put permafrost in the model. And in fact, that exchange turned into a very interesting collaboration where organic carbon and organic soil layers are now in that model because of that kind of discussion that came about. So I think in our organization, those people that are active in those types of research have come because of opportunities that are available around really good research questions that are appropriate for, that NCAR is interested in, and that the Canadian scientists are working on within our organization. There is an umbrella organization over CMOS and CGU. Those organizations may not like it called an umbrella organization because it's actually probably less active than the individual scholarly societies, called the Canadian Society of Geophysical Sciences, and they play a coordinating role amongst them, and they actually have had a tremendous amount of effort of getting those societies together at certain meetings together that where they have common themes to play, which then does play out a little bit like an AGU meeting. On the second point, on the individual basis, those people in our organization that are active with NCAR are active around particular research questions, as I mentioned. One, there's been a number of us that have been working with getting the organic soils into the land surface model, working particularly with David Lawrence and Bill Riley. And, in fact, that's actually worked two ways. They have become involved in a number of organizations that we have that have been working in the soil sciences and on the peatlands, where they've come to actually our meetings to learn about how you might approach these various things. So the exchange is actually not back and forth. There's also a fair bit of work that's being done through the various different carbon projects, particularly on model intercomparisons that are being done that our members are actively involved in. But I'll say the basis of all this has been opportunistic research collaborations that have come forward. There are some significant differences in Canada and the United States. One is how funding is organized for science in Canada. It's a bit different than the way it's organized before. We are a little bit different of a federation in the sense of the way the provinces are organized and the feds are organized and the way that they fund things with the universities. But I think there's potential opportunities there. And the last thing I'll finish with is that we were charged with what the next 2 to 4 years, the research efforts that would be there. I would say that the three big things that our organization's involved in and people are actually working with is the issue of permafrost and Arctic climate change, the issues of soil carbon and its stability or instability in the models, and the third is getting useful algorithms in the models for methane.
Not following my own rules. In terms of those research priorities you identified, I appreciate that you were very specific in those. What do you see that's going on in Canada now that kind of needs to happen? Is it field work? Is it improved testing of models? Like, so these were three. I mean, they're related to your areas of interest, of course, but they're really important. I agree. And what do you know? Where are we in those kind of areas, and how could how does it fit in with the discussion today?
Well, we're involved in both. I mean, I think the first thing is that there is a wealth of knowledge that has been gained from empirical research in the North, but also there is that empirical research has expanded to now what I would say continuous and semi-continuous monitoring networks for things like carbon, methane, that are absolutely essential in model evaluation, model calibrations going forward. And there are a number of groups, LTAS group at McMaster, Mike Rupier, the people that I work with at McGill, and a few other places that are actually working on models that have functions and algorithms in them that we get calls from Bill Riley and David and saying, well, okay, we don't work at the resolution you work at. If we try this through a statistical approach to be able to look at heterogeneity, how will that work? So I think that there's direct discussions that happen outside of the working groups but are part of people that are part and parcel of those working groups in those areas. And I think identifying those three areas is, are areas that I know that land land model working group, yep, is involved in trying to resolve in within their inside the NCAR modeling group. So I mean, it's I think we feed off each other in those types of things. So and I'll say that the Canadian component, I don't want to overemphasize it, is a very minor component because there's a lot of other groups from the States and from Europe that are also providing input to that group.
Right. The timing is important because CMIP, the next version, CESM2, and whatever, I don't know if any of the development will go into WRF, but certainly for CLM, the next couple of years are critical. If anything, any changes are going to be made, they have to be incorporated soon. So it is actually good to know if what the Canadian community is doing, you know, to contribute to that on this kind of time horizon.
Yeah, I should say that establishing those priorities is not that's just talking to our members, and it's things that they're already working on and already doing some exchange with. So,
I have a question. Is, you know, like AGU and like AMS, is there anything that CGU could be doing in conjunction with UCAR to facilitate further collaborations and research?
That's an interesting question. I asked Brian, and Brian's reply to me about that was, well, the Canadian scholarly societies that are involved in atmospheric science, in land surface earth science, is a bit like the federal government and the provinces in the sense that we're somewhat of a dysfunctional federation in the way that we operate. And I mean, for years we've been talking about trying to do some coordinated efforts in research programs, and we've not found the ability really to find, even under threats of when we were doing the reviews for NSERC, for example, through putting our foot forward for increased funding in the earth sciences, we really couldn't coordinate ourselves very well. So I think as an agency for coordinating research, we've not been particularly good in the progressive manner. I'll say that we have been very good as being facilitators of disseminating the research that comes out of that. So, for example, GWEX and CMOS both were really, really involved in some of their collaborative meetings in the sense of presenting major results from the GWEX and have presented some of the major ones from Fluxnet Canada, from Boreas and those types of things. So in a reactive mode, we've been very good in that way, but we've not been particularly progressive, I think.
Okay, so let's move on. The next speaker I would like to ask to say a few words is Bill.
Oh, surprise, wake up.
Well, I thought we had a telecon and we had quite a different order and stuff. But anyway, I'm ready to go.
I don't remember the order.
I said last, so anyway. No, I'm ready to go, no problem. So I actually took a look at the charge to this panel, which was moving forward in atmospheric and earth system science. I saw that somewhere. Okay? So I read that, and that's what I will speak to. Where do we move forward? And, of course, I added 20 minutes to say where we were, so that gives me an added advantage. So thank you for that. So first of all, you know, I speak for the Climate and Global Dynamics Division primarily, but I think a lot will translate into M-Cube and the WRF people, and I think a little less to ACD, and I'll make that point, the chemistry people.
So we have a community or system model, and I hear community used a lot. And one of the main things we have to do to look forward is, what does community mean? And up to now, it has meant NCAR scientists and university scientists, but also the Department of Energy laboratories. And that third, or that third piece, which is another agency with sort of completely orthogonal funding streams from our NSF ones, has been extremely valuable. Whether that can be relied on in the future, we will see. But I know Wharf would say they get an awful lot out of the Air Force, for example. So there is this other injection of not only funding, but vitality and also codes and work and a lot more people. So that's going to be an important part in the future. We've heard about the need to collaborate, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to become more so, not less so. So we're going to have to watch very carefully that we have these, what our community is, and that it's as broad as possible with different flavors, okay? So that said, you look at the current state of affairs, and especially the near future, where a level program is going to be the new plus. There's not going to be great growth in much. I'm not going to sit back and wait. That's a good, most likely scenario to plan for. Level program is good, okay? But the boundaries of Earth system modeling are expanding. People want to do more and more things. I mean, the Earth system is almost infinite. I mean, you can granular down, and you can see the new areas. But when you get into the human dimensions of how much more how you can expand into there, let alone the chemistry and biogeochemistry and species and get into phosphorus cycles, et cetera, it's ever expanding. Our collaborative proposals at NCAR, which we've used over the last 5 years to adapt to what has been declining funding and actually come up with more rather than less funding out of those because of the success, they're almost maxed out, as far as I can tell. That's not the way forward. The CLIVAR climate process teams, as I said, are ongoing, but it's not going to expand. The research initiatives in NSF are ending in 2019. And we'll just have to see where DOE goes. So when the current state of affairs is, in my view, is when the time is sort of right, you know, science has got to a certain point, everybody leaps to the next thing almost in unison, and efforts tend to move together into new areas and follow closely behind, with the point is they're all doing duplicative stuff. And that's everybody works on the same thing just about the same time independently. And it's not very efficiently. And so I think we have to maybe try to think about doing better with the dollars we have rather than wait for new dollars. So ways to stall things is to go off with business as usual, where we have no strategic planning really for science or its implementation. We just keep going. That will stall us. We won't grow. We won't get where we want to go that way. And, you know, when airplanes stall, they actually fall. They don't just sit there stalled, right? I think, as I said, I think groups working on the same thing in very similar ways. And when they do that, the choices you make as a scientist on what way to go becomes based on familiarity. You know, I was struck by a lot of the forecast models that I heard about last week at this conference. You know, you can just see, you know, they choose this suite of parameterizations. Well, that's because they came from their lab. And it's familiarity, not fidelity, not tested carefully. It's what are you comfortable with? What do you know how to tune and tweak? And that's not the way forward. This is a way to stall, in my view. And there's 2 points coming up. If we let science be paced by increases in computing, we're going to stall. And I think Al Kelly spoke very well in his talk on Thursday. And he mentioned it again today, that the science should be the driver, not the computing. And, you know, I think NWP many times has said, just give me more computing power and I'll do better. I think that's a way to stall, because it's going to be very difficult to keep at the same growth paces in computing. There are heat losses that are starting to hit and things like that. Al did a wonderful job of sort of saying why it's not going to be business as usual. The other way to stall is just to sit back and say, we can't do anything more till we get more funding. Because I think we'll just sit here and wait, we'll stall. So, what do we do? Ways forward. Well, our CSM advisory board, which I mentioned earlier, has been extremely forward-looking, and they're very erudite. And the board chair at the time was Isaac Held, who is nobody's fool and a very wise man. He thought that CESAB is, in fact, extensible to the Earth system problem. And now we start thinking of various ways to do that. To get the simple one out of the way first, we really started to take pieces of code and modularize them so that they can be put into a portable piece of code that many institutions can use. And when we can start working with GFDL like that, we can work with anyone like that. And that has many, many reasons to do this. One is we cannot have expertise and critical masses in all parts of the code when it gets to be the size it is. Pieces of code are going to have to, one, stay untouched for a long time, but still have to work on completely different architecture. So you have to hand it over to software engineers. And maybe one institution will be able to really keep a piece of physical code up to date and then pass it back to users. We can't all be doing the same thing all the time. And there are some examples of how that started. The big one, and I think the one most appropriate here, I think the only way forward for us, and I think Worf might say the same thing, is we have to tap the potential that resides in the university community. That's where the big untapped potential, in my view, is. Now, you might say, well, we're not getting any new money either, but, you know, American universities, a lot of people do have 6 to 9 months' salary. That's not a trivial piece of change. And in Canada, it's usually 12 months. And this room alone, I think we had enough salary spent today to cover a half-time FTE somewhere. Just a quick number I did. So there's money there if we can channel it and we don't duplicate. And we, so on the duplication, you know, most of your universities will have Economics 101 courses. And the only thing I remember from Economics 101 that made any sense was that, well, you do what you do best, and then you trade. So, for example, taking the peat moss, or the permafrost, not peat moss, permafrost, let's suppose, or peat, both. Okay, let's suppose that's the best thing you do. Even if we could do it better back in Boulder, being further away from the problem, we shouldn't do it if we can do something else better. We should let you do it and then trade you. And that's the only part of Economics 101 that made sense, because you produce more and then you just equally trade it. And I think we have to sort of start thinking along these lines, where we do delegate some research responsibilities to people and institutions that have expertise, and then we trade, rather than all do the same thing and pretend we have the best because we're familiar with it. And I want a good example is CESM has completely outsourced the land ice model. There is no land ice modeler at NCAR. It is all university community and a lot of DOE. And we have to do that kind of thing. And in fact, we made a strategic decision in a recent hire. We would not go that way. We didn't need another subcritical unit. All right? And I think those are ways forward. And Well, maybe instead of questions, you might just tell me where I'm really wrong. So I'm rather optimistic, actually, because I see the younger generation of scientists, probably taught by many of you people, are much more flexible along these lines. They don't have to be the best on everything, but they want to work on lots of things. They want to see the broad picture. So I hate to say that I'm optimistic, but I am. Even now, things could be a lot worse than they are. We're sort of getting along relatively well, and that's the way forward to me. But we're not very efficient, that's for sure. And the universities, as I say, I think have a huge role. That's the untapped thing. I would rather try get those resources than, say, try and go for government or private industry resources, which are, you know, typically limited duration, and keeping them sustained is difficult. I think universities.
So, as I listen to this, when you began to talk about the Earth system model, it seems to me that there's a need to engage a much broader community to get involved, and that brings to mind the whole concept of research collaborations. Generally, we as disciplinarians, people who are involved strictly in one discipline, are not very well practiced in going out to different communities, such as the private sector or social scientists. So how do we go and seek out properly the expertise necessary to complete this model of the whole Earth system?
Well, part of my optimism is that our generation is like that, but the younger ones aren't. They seem to be ready to really put their fingers across disciplines much more. At your level, or my level, we have to make sure that those people don't fall between the cracks like they did for many years. I'm very optimistic about how nimble and how flexible the newest generation is. Now, that's just my own observation, and if others have a different observation, I'd be happy to hear it, because I have limited experience, but that's how.
Yeah, I like this model a lot and the suggestion, but in Canada it does mean that we would have to have certain innovations that we'd have to see, and I don't necessarily mean additional money, but I mean different ways of doing the financing that we're doing of research now. And, I mean, Elizabeth is here from NSERC. NSERC used to have a very good program that had a very small amount of money in it, but did facilitate, for example, international collaborations that would have happened with somebody like NCAR. For very good reasons, largely lack of finances, that program was cut as NSERC's budgets were cut. But it may mean that we need to rethink about actually how funding is done in the sense of flexibility to allow these types of opportunities to rise. Also, there's certain rules about what can constitute as a legitimate collaborator for research in the sense that it needs to be private sector as opposed to a government agency, which we may need to think about the world a little bit differently than we did before. That's not a criticism. That's just saying that's one of the challenges ahead of it, and we have to think more broadly in the way that we do this to facilitate the type of thing you're talking about.
I think you can also phrase that as in an economics term. I mean, the funding agents, those little pots were the first thing to go when things get cut because you have your strategic grants. But if you start to think in an economics point of view, where can I invest for the best return? For example, if Canadian funding invested in a CPT at a very modest extent, they might get an enormous return back from their investment, not only to the individuals involved, but to the all of Canadian science, for example. Now, that is an economics argument, and that makes some sense, but whether you could actually implement it or not, I do not know.
Well, I think we need to move on. Try to hold the discussion towards the end. Pierre, I'd like to hear from you. Pierre has been active, actually, in the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society, and we'd like to have his perspective on that, considering that Nigel is here from CGU as well.
Thank you, John. So I was very impressed by what I saw this morning in the presentation of the everything that goes on at NCAR and that can help the community to support research. And I think it has a lot of flexibility that is very well suited for research, and I think it's really impressive, and I think the whole community will benefit from it. And so I would certainly have my students, you know, and some are already doing it, okay, try to use the system. But I'm very glad that Bill spoke before me, because he made many points that I wanted to make, that at the moment the research, and we saw that at the Open Science Conference, it's a really going towards, you know, the full Earth system for weather and climate application, but the system is extremely complex, and to build that from scratch, I think it's very difficult. But the most importantly is that if you look at these systems like they are developed in operational center, like ECMWF and other places, you can realize the complexity of validating this system. It's a lot more than just developing it. You need to validate it, and you need to compare that to lots of observation. So when you work with simple system, it's fine to do process studies about one process, and you can validate it. But I think the old issues about the Earth system and even current atmospheric model is to validate the interaction in between all of these processes. And if you want to compare to real observations, and that actually you have centers who assimilate 40 million pieces of data every day, so that's quite a large volume, and to agree with them all, it requires a very finely validated system. So some research, okay, require that, particularly if you have these collaboration with centers, as we do at my university under the regional climate model. So it's built upon the Environment Canada model, and this is what the Uranus Consortium is using also. So we have, in a sense, a client that needs a carefully validated model, and also it allows us to take part in these international intercomparison experiment, and we're able to stand our ground. So that's fine, and we need to have that kind of research in universities as well. But in my view, I think we need both. We need to have something simple that you can play with easily just to explore new ideas. But in the end, you go towards a very complex and finely tuned model when you want to confront it to observation. To me, it's like going to the laboratory to see if you have everything right. So even if each process is carefully validated, when you look at them interacting with one another, you get a different picture. But that being said, okay, I think that we obviously we can benefit a lot from the what NCAR has to offer, and I think we're already benefiting from all that. But one thing that this can do, on top of having code, software, and everything, I think it unites a community in terms of having people who work on different processes, being aware that there are others working as well on the added components. And then when these communities interact, they learn about these interacting processes. So I think this is what we should be aiming for. And I think this is, at least from our perspective in my university, I think this is what we do in a sense. Use simpler system, but at the same time more complex one. And as far as CMOS is concerned, well, I think CMOS really represents the whole atmospheric and oceanographic community in Canada. We certainly can, CMOS can convey the message all across its members, okay, to send a message that, that it's not, if you are using the WARF model or the CSM, that you're not alone. There's a whole Canadian community. And in a sense, we can have some kind of substation for user support. For instance, us at UQAM, we're just a few blocks from McGill, and we have people using WARF, both at McGill and UQAM. And we work on the same computer, because I think that's the another point. In Canada, in terms of computing resources, we have a lot to Compute Canada. McGill alone has a computer that has over, if I recall correctly, 24,000 cores. So that's not no small machine. You go at Sherbrooke University, they have 40,000 cores. University in Montreal equally, and there are in Toronto. So we have computers, but then, you know, we need to have proper model to do meaningful research. So I think this is my, just hearing what I heard this morning, I think it has this benefit for us to develop a sense of a community, so that people can help each other instead of, as you said, duplicating their effort. So that's my take on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes.
This relates to, I had my hand up earlier.
Yeah.
I think there's a complementary aspect that goes on with this, because on the one hand, I think you want to have multiple people doing things to sort of check, and different groups doing things in different ways. And at the same time, I understand that in terms of efficiency, one would think, well, maybe there's one way of doing things. But I think the process has to go through some sort of filtering in the scientific community to sort of work things out, and eventually things settle, and there's a way of doing things. I know in my experience in the middle atmosphere, there were a number of groups doing radiative transfer calculations, and out of comparisons with each other, each got refined a bit more, and so you eventually got a better product, but different people were doing things differently out of that. So to go directly to, well, we're just going to do it this way, I'm not sure scientifically is the best way. In the longer term, for operational kinds of things, I guess maybe that is where we have to end up. But that was just a comment that I have.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that in terms of certain research projects, collaborations are essential, but in other particularly small projects, consensus is not necessarily the right answer, unlike in forecasting. It's oftentimes individuals who make these seemingly small contributions that are absolutely crucial, so we try to push this along. The way that I see this, and I think we've got just a very few minutes left, is that researchers basically need resources, and the question is, how is it that we can expand our horizons, get more resources? Those resources include facilities, and for a theoretician, for example, you might need a blackboard or a pencil and paper, and that's it, ranging up to folks who need airplanes, even yours from way back. I'm getting there. And then, of course, the additional resources involves the student body and what sort of students you can get, and finally, money to pay the students and your staff. So those are major issues. And going back to the comment, I think, Wayne, that you made earlier about science and how scientists seemingly have been made to be followers rather than leaders, this is an important issue. There's a lot of different opinions about this, but we as a scientific community in our particular discipline need to take the bull by the horns and be leaders and force the issue by taking a role of leadership. How to do that, it's not altogether clear. We can't solve that in just a few minutes. But your point, I think, is well taken. And I think Charles Lynn has pointed out that we as a university community really need to get our act together. And I would hope that within the guise of UCAR, we can do that. And UCAR is designed to explicitly facilitate the university community to get their act together and push forward. Yes?
I just had one comment. All four speakers have basically spoken about the big models and the computer models.
Yep.
There's not been a lot said about experiment, and it worries me a little bit in the community that there's this belief that one day we're going to build this supercomputer model which can do everything and we never need to provide any experimental data at all. I think experimental collaboration is one area which is still has to be as strong as it ever has in the past, and there's a feeling in my heart that we're starting to lose that experimental collaboration in favor of models.
Okay, point well taken. Yes, one more question.
I'll just make two quick comments here regarding the Bill's comment about delegating the task to certain groups. They do well. If people are doing the multiple efforts, then these are the breeding grounds and the training grounds for the next generation as well. So if the more people are being trained, then we hope more advancement will be made and more innovation will come out of it. That's one aspect. The other aspect I would like to make in terms of the contribution from the Canadian community, academic, as well as Environment Canada and other agencies, that they have a very strong wealth of the data, measurements data. Canada is a vast country with diverse areas, land surface areas, and Canadian community is very rich with the data, and those data are very essential for the model validations. So if there is an effort to get this data and capitalize on that, that will be one other way that we can contribute into this aspect.
Okay. Well, I think we'll have to stop there and move on now to the second.